This is July the 25th, 2004, and I'm Kira Viewitt calling from Columbus, Ohio, and I'm talking with Leo LaBelle, who is in Huntington, Connecticut. It's about 11 o'clock in the morning, and we'll just kind of start with where you were born and raised, where you grew up.
Okay, I was born and raised in Manchester, New Hampshire. I was born in 17 March 1943, which makes me 61. And my parents were also born and raised in Manchester, but we were about third generation Franco-Americans. I have one brother, Andy, who currently lives in Texas, and that's the only siblings that I have.
Mm-hmm. And what does your brother do?
My brother is a CPA down in Fort Worth.
Mm-hmm. And what did your parents do?
My parents were basically laborers. Both of them had gone through grammar school but never got to high school. And so they held a number of different jobs. My mother primarily worked in the textile mills in Manchester, which was the largest industry there for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad, who had become a machinist and stuff, held a number of different jobs. He'd worked at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard during the war, and later held other different positions, one in a brush manufacturing company, and at the time of his death, he was a guard at one of the local reform schools.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it was just you and your brother growing up.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And what did you say you had a normal childhood? Was it exceptional in any way, or...?
I don't think it was exceptional in any way. It was, I think it was pretty typical of the kind of upbringings most other people that were my contemporaries had in that area. At the time that I grew up, Manchester was physically divided by the Merrimack River, and the primary ethnic population on the east side of the river was Irish Catholic, and on the west side, French Catholics. Over the years, I guess there's been some animosity between the two groups and stuff. On the side where I grew up were primarily French-American, second or third generation French-speaking people. Most of the people that I grew up with went to parochial schools. There were some that went to public schools, but clearly the parochial schools outnumbered the public schools at the time. The kind of activities and things that we were involved with were, I think, pretty typical at the time, but I certainly don't recall anything spectacular that would have, you know, made any of us different, I think, than most other people growing up in that area.
Mm-hmm. And was growing up in an ethnic neighborhood, was that kind of a big part of your life, or was it just...
I don't think it was. I think it was just a part of the life. I mean, as a kid, I'm not sure I was even aware of or thinking about it in those terms. Only vaguely aware that there were, you know, other ethnic groups elsewhere, but it just seemed natural that the people who had migrated down from Canada had tended to group together, and I was in the group that needed to belong to. So.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that there was anything special about it or that I thought about it much.
Uh-huh. And growing up as a kid, did you think about nursing as a career, or did you come into that later?
That's an interesting story. by the time that I got to high school, I went to at the time that I started high school, I ended up going to an all-boys Catholic high school that was actually a consolidated high school for all of the parochial grammar schools in the region. And like most of the kids in those days, I was looking for summer employment when I got to be about 15 or 16. And my first job was at a local hospital. It was cleaning up in the x-ray department. At the end of the day, stuff after school, I would get down and clean the x-ray department. That I did for approximately about a year or so. I say I started at the bottom because one of my tasks was to start to clean the x-ray rooms after the barium enemas. And I figured that was really starting at the bottom, and I've worked my way up since then.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of that job, it was really just a job. One of my best friends had beat me in the door, so to speak. He was already working there doing the same kind of thing. And so he had told me about the job. I went down and applied, and we both worked there for about a year, year and a half in that time frame. Now, after that, I wanted to make a little more money and stuff, and there were jobs open for orderlies. And so I ended up taking a course to become an orderly, and that course was taught by a registered nurse by the name of Ruth Slattery. And Ruth was one of those people who was a very good people person and a good instructor and stuff, and I learned a lot from her. But it was still, to me at that time, just a job. When I finished high school, I went off to college. And at the time that I finished high school, I didn't know what it was that I wanted to do. So I sought out some counseling and advice of people. And the general rule that I got, I took the usual test and all those things. The test indicated I should become a nurse. But I, of course, at that time didn't pay much attention to that. There were a lot of other options that came in a close second. And based on the fact that I didn't know what it was that I wanted to do, most of the counselors advised me to take a business college course. And so that's what I did. I trucked off to Boston College in 1960 in the School of Business. And I was there 2 years. It was basically a very, as I'm sure it is for a lot of college kids, my first time away from home. A time for real personal growth, but also a lot of confusion at that time. I didn't really know what I wanted to be and didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. In any case, I took the courses. I didn't do very well, but I grew increasingly dissatisfied with what I was doing. And by the middle or so of my second year, my sophomore year of college, I decided that this really wasn't the route that I wanted to go to. And I thought more and more about coming back into healthcare and becoming a nurse. And I made a somewhat clandestine call, because I didn't want anybody else to find out about it at the time, to Ruth Slattery, and discussed my concerns at that time with her. And over the course of several months of additional phone calls and counseling by her, I did leave college and ended up applying to the nursing school. It was a 3-year diploma nursing program at Sacred Heart Hospital, where I had been working in Manchester, New Hampshire. And so I ended up applying. And in those days, of course, that was pretty unusual. But I did end up applying and then got accepted. And the rest, as they say, is history.
And what was it?
I got into it, but it was kind of natural evolution from my first couple of jobs. As a teenager, and then growing dissatisfaction and clarification, I guess, of what it was that I wanted to do with my life.
Mm-hmm. And what was it that was unusual? You said when you left college and went to the 3-year program in the hospital, that was somewhat unusual.
Well, I think, first of all, there are a couple of things that I think are both important in terms of understanding what it was that I did and what the time was like it was early 1960s, around 1962, when I started the nursing program. In those days, this was a small Catholic hospital in a rather puritanical New England atmosphere. It was certainly unusual for men to go into nursing. There were all the usual stereotypes about men being homosexual, etc., who went into nursing. I was aware of, but wasn't particularly bothered by some of that. It, for some reason, didn't really bother me much that people might think that. But there clearly were a lot of very real concerns from people. There were a lot of stereotypes. At the time that I started my nursing program, there were only about 1% of the total nursing population in the United States were men. Today it's about pushing around 8%. so the change has been slow. But at the time, it was unusual. I ended up being accepted into the nursing program. I was the only male. There were roughly about 200 females in the program, split out amongst the three years worth of classes. There was a lot of concern because they knew that at some point it was going to create some problems for the hospital as well. At the time that I started the program, I was the third male in the history of the program. The first two, one was at the time that I started my nursing program, one was the first graduate, was now the assistant administrator for the Department of Nursing, and assistant administrator of the hospital. The second guy who had come along a few years later after the first was at that time operating a nursing home in Florida, is my understanding. I never met that man. So I was number three coming down the pike, but the rules had changed. When the first two guys went through, they didn't have to take obstetrics and gynecology, and they ended up taking a course in urology during the time the girls went off and did OBGYN. But in the interim, until I came along, the rules were changed, and it became mandatory to do OBGYN because it became part of the nursing boards in order to become an RN, so you had to have the course and to pass the, that portion of the examination. So they knew that was going to be present problems. I ended up doing my OBGYN rotation in the latter half of my second year in the nursing program. And by that time, fortunately, I had developed enough of collegial and supportive relationships with other classmates that they were very, very helpful. In fact, one of them is the person who became my wife, and who's we're still married. And I think it's about 36 going on 37 years now. So they would help me out for answering questions that I had or for explaining things and stuff during that rotation. Still, there were some things about it that really made it a little different. I ended up being the first male nurse to take obstetrics in the state of New Hampshire. The only other program that accepted males was at the state hospital in Concord, and they sent their students to a hospital in New Jersey for their OBGYN experience, and being a large city down there was never a problem, but it was a problem for us, or for me, at the time that I went through my program. Fortunately, Ruth Slattery, who's the person I mentioned earlier, was also the supervisor for the OBGYN department, and she had no problems at all with having me around, but she knew she had to be somewhat selective about who she picked as my first patient to be with for delivery, because she knew everybody was going to talk, and they were already talking, and there were all kinds of apprehensions and stuff, so she had to be very careful. And so the first patient that I had in obstetrics was a patient by the name of Jane Pukigo. And she was kind of the ideal patient to go through this with me. Jane was a civil engineer who, along with her husband, ran a construction company. And Jane can tell you how many feet of concrete you need to make a 200-foot driveway and those kinds of things. But at the time she got through civil engineering school, she was the only girl in her class of 200 guys, because there was not yet the women's lib era, and women were still pretty much prescribed to traditional roles as were the guys. So both of us were in kind of non-traditional roles. Jane was having her third baby, and she didn't have a problem having me around at all, and everything went off without a hitch, and it was not, never a big thing. I saw her once or twice after that, and she still was, you know, not at all unhappy with the experience. But at least it went well, and so there were a lot of people's fears were unfounded, and after that there wasn't as much of a problem.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have, were other patients ever concerned, or was it ever an issue with other patients later?
Well, I think that people generally were not aware. I think a lot of, probably a lot of patients just automatically assumed that I was a physician, even though maybe nobody ever said that or tried to mislead a patient about who I was and stuff. But I think it was just the natural tenure of the times. People, again, were much more attuned to traditional roles, and they tended to see men as physicians and women as nurses. And so the fact that I was a nurse never really occurred to them, I don't think. It isn't that I didn't experience some other either criticisms or experiences as I went through the nursing program, where my status as a nurse came up as an issue. But there really weren't the kind of everyday kinds of problems. It wasn't until the mid-60s and later that people started questioning traditional roles, and that would have become much more of an issue. The issue of individual rights and stuff wasn't as prominent then as it was after the mid-60s. So I think people just kind of went along with it and never really thought too much about it. It was, in my view, it was a real time of lack of sophistication. People were pretty naive about traditional roles. I think if you matched it up against people today in the same age categories, the views would be entirely different.
And how were your relationships with the other nurses? Did any of the other female nurses have issues with you being there? Were they pretty supportive?
In large, they didn't confront them. Now, I have to answer that question. I have to say, first and foremost, that the students, the girls who were with me in my class, were generally very supportive. And for the most part, I think so too were the other students. I think there was an inherent sympathy of one student for another, regardless of sex. So there really wasn't a problem with the students, except in those days, the nursing school had its own dorm for the students, and the dorm had a dorm house mother kind of individual, and there were curfews for the girls, and they had to be in, I think it was 8 o'clock, on school nights, okay? And I was the only male allowed into the building past the receiving parlor, and so that made some of the boyfriends jealous. But that was really the only negative experience, I think, that I can remember with my classmates. Now, with the staff nurses, again, encompassing a pretty wide range of age groups, there were some newer graduates, i.e., who had been nurses less than 5 years, who were probably, for the most part, under 30 years of age at the time, who were pretty accepting and supportive and didn't really hassle me much. Some of the older nurses who were, say, in their 55, 60 and older range really communicated that they didn't think I should be around or should not have been allowed into the program. Sometimes it created some problems. One of the things in the OB rotation, for example, was that at that time, as opposed to today, the OB rotation was a 3-month rotation. One spent a month in labor and delivery. One spent a month on the postpartum floor, and one spent a month in the newborn nursery. And especially I remember when I was in the newborn nursery, in those days we used, there were no such things as disposable diapers, and so we used regular diapers, and we had to clean them ourselves and stuff. So that was a role that fell to the students. And so there would be those times when I would be on and get assigned that task of washing the diapers, and some of the older nurses would just come and stand in the doorway and just give me the evil eye and not say a thing, but great pleasure in watching me do that. And, you know, my attitude was at the time, I think, was basically, well, you know, I'm going to do this regardless, and I'm not going to let you get me down. And I just made it sound like it was the greatest thing in the world to wash diapers. And anyways, I got through it, and there were never any open confrontation, though. Nobody openly criticized me. I think that just would have not been something people at that time would have done. And nobody did. We discussed it. I discussed it with some friends and advisors, and I was concerned that some of those things might crop up, but they never really did.
Mm-hmm. And where did you live?
At that time, I was living at home. I had my folks owned a home in South Manchester, and I had my own transportation, and so I would go to school every day. I was basically a day student.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived at home. And again, it wasn't much of a problem from that standpoint. When I dropped out of college in Boston, I come home and was living at home for that time and all the way through the time I came into the military.
Uh-huh. And was that something that they allowed you to do because the housing situation would have been a problem? I mean, were there female nurses who lived at home as well, or did they make them
There were a number of nurses, students who were contemporaries of mine who lived at home. In fact,
okay.
Probably at that time the majority did.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. Hmm. And what did your family think about you going into nursing?
Interesting. I can't say again. It just wasn't a time when people would openly criticize.
Mm-hmm.
I think people who were my extended family, so aunts, uncles, cousins, those kinds of things, may have had some private thoughts that they didn't share with me. Nobody again openly confronted me. I think in terms of that particular time, there were some that were, I think, pretty supportive. I can remember a couple of aunts and stuff that didn't have any problem with it and were generally openly supportive. On the other hand, I can't say that I'm convinced that they were all very supportive. I think that a lot of them probably shared the stereotypes that I mentioned earlier. Now, my immediate family, I think I had been the first person in my family, both sides, my parents' side, my mother's side, to go off to college. And at the time that I did, I think that was seen as a major leap forward, for the family. I think that was an important thing that they saw as important and as an extension of the things that they had not been able to achieve themselves in their own lives. And so I think they were very much hep on my going off to college. And then when I dropped out, I remember the biggest trepidation that I had when I made the decision to apply to the nursing school was telling my folks that I was going to do that. And interestingly enough, and I'm not surprised given my folks, but they were very accepting. I always sensed that they were disappointed that I left college at that time and to go to a three-year, what was in those days, a diploma of nursing programs. In those days, most of the nursing programs in the United States were diploma-based, were not college-based. And so I think in that sense, they sensed that I'd made a bad decision, and they were probably a little disappointed. Later, when I got my degrees and stuff and achieved a college education, I think they felt better about it. And I think my mother, at least, my dad never said too much, but my mother, I think, was very supportive of what I had chosen to do. And I think it was more important for her to know that I was happy doing what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about that, and if one can really make conclusions from kind of general experiences, I think my mother had always seen me as the person who was more of a caregiver kind of individual. That is, when people, like if she was sick or things, I was the one who kind of naturally expressed concern and would try to help out in whatever way I could and stuff. So from that general kind of thing, she maybe was not overly surprised about how I ended up.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't say she was other than openly supportive, and if she had any reservations about it, except for the fact that perhaps a general sense of disappointment my having dropped out of college, really wasn't very disappointed otherwise about it.
And you said that there were a couple instances where you being a male nurse was an issue. Did those come about in nursing school, or was that later?
A couple of them occurred in nursing school. Actually, most of my negative experiences with regards to being a male in nursing occurred during the program. And there were, looking back, really kind of the worst ones I've already told you about. when I was on affiliation for pediatrics, for a pediatric rotation, we went to Boston Floating Hospital in the downtown Boston area. And there were a large number of guys because they came from programs from around, especially New England, there were people there from the various Boston programs. There were people from Connecticut and Rhode Island and Maine and stuff. So I was not the only guy on that rotation. And I remember one particular afternoon, we were working the 3 to 11 shift, and it was midsummer, it was like July, it was very hot in Hewitt, there was no air conditioning in the hospital in those days. And there were, I think, three guys on, two other guys and myself, that were the only students on the floor that particular afternoon. And a patient was admitted, and the mother just absolutely refused to believe that there was any such thing as a male nurse. She kept insisting that we were all physicians. And, you know, it at first was bothersome from the standpoint that we were trying to set her straight, but it quickly became apparent after, you know, continued discussions over the early part of the afternoon that she wasn't going to believe us, and there was just no point in us continuing to try to persuade her. So basically, we just ignored her and went on and took care of the kids, including her child. And I don't know that to this day she recognizes such a thing. Male nurses. Those kinds of little bothersome experiences occurred, but nothing really major. I mean, we're not talking here about the kind of situation that I think people envision, that the stuff of TV dramas where someone says, "You're not going to take care of my wife because you're a male."
Right.
And I don't know if you know that, but there's a lawsuit that just arose a few months ago down, I believe, in South Carolina along those lines. So those things still do occur. But I never personally experienced them, nor do I know of any guys who experienced that level of open hostility or problems.
That's funny. She just would not believe that you were male nurses. Did she just think you were lying, or?
That was a totally alien thought to her. And again, given the times, we're talking about 1963-64 here. I think that you would have to, if you look back at it, it wouldn't seem strange. It seems strange by today's standards that somebody would be so uninformed, but it really wasn't at that time. It was rare enough. I mean, given that Boston Floating was a really big-time referral center for pediatrics, probably most of the parents who had been there in their own hospitals where their kids were first seen probably had never run across a male nurse either.
Mm-hmm.
So they just didn't know anything other than the fact that males were physicians and females were nurses.
Mm-hmm.
How they lived their lives.
And had you ever encountered female physicians at that point?
Let me see. If I did, I cannot really recall a specific incident. The first time I remember running into female physicians that I can remember specific incidences and stuff in terms of my interactions with them, was in the military and probably sometime after 1975 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these people had gotten into medical school after the women's lib movement and a real shift in gender equality movement. And by the time those people hit the military and I ran across them, and I ran across them in the military, I think in part because the Uniformed Services University was probably one of the first to provide equal opportunity for those medical students. I think they were on board faster than some of the civilian medical schools. But anyways, that's where I first ran across them. And my interestingly enough, over the years I have found that women physicians generally are much more supportive of male nurses than you would expect. You would think that there might be some animosity between the two. And there isn't, because a lot of our experiences in overcoming stereotypes, I think, were very, very similar. So that there really wasn't, and has not been, for me anyways, a problem getting along with female physicians. If there's been a problem getting along with them, it's for other things than gender. It's been, practice-based or something along those lines. But never had an experience where somebody rejected me or I got into an argument or something with somebody simply because of the differences in gender. It just didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. And you said that one of the female nurses that you met in nursing school actually became your wife, right?
Yes.
And so you guys met, were you in the same class? Is
we
that?
In the same class. And there were, let's see, there were 200 girls in the school. There were approximately about, I want to say somewhere around 45 in my class, 45 to 50, somewhere around there. They came pretty much from throughout New England. We were, for the most part, all about the same age group. There were one or two that were a few years older. I was a few years older at that point because I was, let's see, about 19 or 20. Most of them were probably 17 or 18 at that point. I dated some of them, my classmates and stuff, occasionally during the program. There was really, at that time, more group activity, and I won't say it was group dating. It was primarily getting together for coffee for study sessions and those kinds of things. That was probably, at least early on, the greater portion of my, quote, social life at the time. My wife was part of one of those groups. There were about five or six of the girls and me. We really got along very well together. And my wife wasn't particularly interested in me at the time. And, in fact, kind of probably disliked me. She'll even admit to it. So. Was there a problem? No. That group I found very, very supportive. They generally helped. Everybody in the group helped each other out. There was never a real problem. My wife and I didn't start dating until, mid to late my second year. It must have been in the middle or late of period of my second year in nursing school. We were going out intermittently at that point. By the time that we graduated, we were going out on a fairly steady basis. Then I was going right into the military, and I had 2 years of my anesthesia training program to get through. And my wife and I ended up getting married about 6 months before I graduated from that program. So by the time we got married, my wife and I had been dating almost 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when did you join the student nurse program?
At the end of my second year. Army at that time, as I guess most of the services, but I know the Army in particular, had an active recruitment program for nurses. Vietnam had started up. They needed more medical personnel. The Army Student Nurse Program, which is no longer exists, was then in effect, and basically for a 2-year commitment, they were going to pay for your last year in school. Well, in those days, the draft was still in effect. I was prime draft age, and I knew that it was going to be only a matter of time before they would draft me. So by my signing up, I was going to fulfill my draft obligation, plus get a little money to pay for my schooling, which was certainly helpful. And as it turned out, I got a year's worth of credit towards my military service for retirement, but that was only because I ended up staying for 20 years in the Army. In terms of those experiences, there were actually, I think, a total of 4 or 5 of my classmates who signed up for the military. I was the only one who ever ended up making it onto active duty. And like I say, I ended up staying 20 years. Some of the others signed up initially and were unable to make it in for either physical problems that developed or something along those lines. But I was the only one who ended up serving in the military. But there were 4 or 5 in my class who signed up for the student nurse program.
Mm-hmm. And how did you hear about the student nurse program?
Well, at that time, there were regional recruiters and for the Army, and they went around to all the various nursing schools in the region. And the person who did the recruiting at the time that I went through the program was a male. He and his later counterparts operated out of an office in Boston, but they virtually traveled throughout New England. They would go to Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut. So they came through and gave a spiel, and when I heard that and knew what I was facing, I inquired further, and then over the course of time ended up signing up for that program.
Mm-hmm. And was this male recruiter, was he a nurse as well, or was he
yes.
just a...
These were all... at that time, the Army Student Nurse Program recruiters were all RNs in the military.
Mm-hmm. And what kinds of things did he tell you when he came in and made his little demonstration or program or talk?
Well, it's not a whole lot different than it is today. Recruiters try to sell you on the bennies, the benefits, and those included, obviously, getting paid while you were going to school, the kind of latitude of practice that you would have in a military setting once you graduated, the fact that you'd be paid as an officer, and that you would have, you know, all kinds of power, prestige, and those kinds of things, some of which, of course, never materialized. There is a little bit of hype, but by and large, they probably don't do anything illegal, and they're probably no different than recruiters in other fields. But they generally try to sell you on the positive things. They didn't emphasize things like getting shot or killed.
Oh, right. Did he have pictures, or do you remember any brochures or anything that you saw or that he had?
I only vaguely. I mean, that's a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about 1964. Because you could only at that time sign up for the Army Student Nurse Program for the last 2 years in a collegiate program and the last year of a diploma program, which is what I was in. So I basically signed on towards the end of my second year and actually was sworn in. I want to, if I remember correctly, somewhere around, must have been about September of 64.
Mm-hmm.
It would take a little bit. So in those days, I can't recall. I mean, I remember there were generally some brochures and those kinds of things, but I can't recall specific items.
Mm-hmm.
There were things that I was generally aware of about the military in terms of, like, medical benefits and those kinds of things. But I can't say I remember specifically one thing or another being touted
mm-hmm.
as a main draw for signing on.
Uh-huh. And did he talk to you specifically about being a male nurse in the military, having had that experience himself?
Well, I can't say that I recall that. I recall being somewhat impressed that it was a male recruiter, because that wasn't what I was expecting, but I can't say we had any specific discussions about that. If there was, it probably would have been restricted to, you know, well, what can I expect as a guy? And I think the answer would have been just as I would give it now. You will be treated as fairly as anybody or any place else that you would ever go.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my experience, that when I came on active duty, all of the potential problems of interactions, negative interactions based on gender, just did not occur. I mean, I found it a very professional, very accepting, very equal treatment kind of situation for both men and women in terms of how they were treated on active duty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And had anybody else in your family served in the military?
No, they had. Well, yes and no. When you say my family, it depends on which point you go to. My dad did not serve in the military. He tried several times to sign up, and they kept making him get a deferral because of his work as a machinist working on submarines at the Naval Yard. And they basically kept him from signing up. He did not serve. My brother did not serve. My brother's 2 years younger than me, and so at that point, he too would have been draft eligible. He fell through a glass door and basically severed a ulnar artery, nerve, and vein, ended up with some dysfunction of his hand, and made him 4F, so he was not eligible for the draft at that time. He was called up and given a physical deferment for that reason. I had aunts and uncles uncles who had served in World War II, basically in the Army and I think Navy.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you think about military service at the time?
Oh, at the time, I knew that the Vietnam War was on and that was eating up a lot of people in terms of how the military was dealing with that. I mean, They're basically going with 1 or 2 year tours. I knew that the buildup was increasing, and I knew that I was draft eligible and would be in the military at some point in time. But I certainly had absolutely no idea of coming into the military and serving for 20 years. That didn't come till much later. I had no intention of making the military a career. I just felt I would serve my 2 year active duty commitment and then get out and go back to family.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think was your major motivation in joining the student nurse program?
It's always the carrot and the stick, you know. And the carrot for me was because Vietnam was on and because they needed large numbers of nurse anesthetists, and by then, when I finished my nursing program, I knew that's the area that I wanted to get into. This provided me the golden opportunity right from the get-go. When I went on active duty, I was sent to Texas for what is called officer basic training. At that time, it was an 8-week course. Today, it's only a few weeks in length. But at that time, it was 8 weeks. I went on active duty around the beginning of September, maybe the end of August, and at the end of October, got reassigned to Walter Reed. But when I first came into the basic course, the officer training course, I was given the opportunity, along with others who were coming in with me at the same time, to apply for the nursing anesthesia program. Five of us applied, and all of us got accepted. So it was very unusual for somebody that new into the military to get accepted for that program. Getting accepted into that program meant a 2-year obligation for each year of schooling. So at that time, it was a year and a half long program, so a 3-year payback. When I finished that program and went to Vietnam, while I was in Vietnam, I was thinking about going back to school to finish my degree, etc., and possibly work on graduate degrees down the line. That motivation led me to sign up to become regular Army. At the time that I was initially in the military, I was a reserve officer. Then I decided I would go regular Army because I knew that would give me an edge in terms of getting further schooling. Doing that gave me another time commitment, and so I ended up packing on a few more years. And when I did come back, I did apply for schooling and did get accepted for going back to school for degree completion and incurred some more time. And by that point in time, when I finished my bachelor's in around 1972, I had enough time in so that it started to become worthwhile to think about staying in the military for a career. And there were, at that time, things that I saw as potential opportunities that I hadn't appreciated before then. So basically, by that time, I started thinking about staying around for that period of time. The other thing that happens is, and if you talk to other military folks, a lot of people who served in the military, it only stayed for one tour, 2 or 3 year tour, probably did not like the military. But if you talk to those who stuck around, one of the things that's a kind of a universal experience is that once you serve 2 or 3 tours, so probably 5, 6, 7 years, you get to appreciate what the military is really all about. You start to think of it as family because now you know people at other locales. And so as you move around from post to post, you're likely to, you know, run across people. And so it's a much more cohesive kind of experience than I think people who have only served one tour have had. And it gets you thinking that the Army or the Navy or whatever it might be is your family. And so I think people become more committed over time. The longer they stay in, I think the more they want to stay in for the most part.
Mm-hmm. And what made you pick the Army instead of, say, the Navy or the Air Force?
I was the guy with the books. They had, well, at the time that I came on active duty, they were the ones that had the largest student nurse program going.
Mm-hmm.
The military medical field was broken down so that the Army's health facilities and training programs were roughly twice as large as both the Navy and the Air Force has put together. So, and I was aware of that, and I thought my chances would be best by going that route.
Mm-hmm.
A few people I know who had signed on with me in the Army later moved to other branches on an inter-branch transfer, but I never considered that.
Mm-hmm. And had you thought about the military or military service in terms of, you know, duty or patriotism or any of those kind of ideas?
I think you gain that over time.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would very strongly be an advocate of all of those views today. But at that time, when I was basically 20 years old, I think I saw it only in a general sense that everybody ought to serve, you know, two-year commitment, because that's what I'd grown up with. The draft had always been around. I was still, as a child, I remember it was immediately post-World War II. You know, in 1947, 48, I was 5 or 6 years old, and there were still plenty of vets around telling, you know, stories about the war in my neighborhood. So I kind of had bought into the idea that at least all men ought to have a commitment of service to their country for some period of time. But I certainly had not considered it in terms of a long-term career, and I had not seen it as a patriotic requirement until really much later in my military career.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you said the draft was still on, and so this was kind of one way to sign up on your terms, I guess?
It met my needs, it met the military's needs, it met the government's needs.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw it as a win-win-win situation.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of did I come on active duty and did I look for service in Vietnam in terms of it being a true patriotic commitment, I can't say that at the time that crossed my mind.
Mm-hmm. And so when you got to Fort Sam for your basic training, were there other male nurses that you met there?
In fact, that was my first real exposure to a real cross-section of relatively new, they were all new graduates, obviously. And at that time, my basic class had roughly 200 people
mm-hmm.
in it. And some of them I knew from activities that while I was going through my generic nursing program, others, the vast majority of them were people who were new to me, I'd never met before. But again, in that 8-week period of time, developed a fair amount of cohesiveness and camaraderie that I think, again, some of those people I ended up keeping in contact with for a number of years after that. But at the time that I went into the basic course, they were running a basic course of roughly 180, 200 people through every 8 weeks or so. And it was a busy place. Of course, a large number of those people did not stay in the military past their initial obligation. And it was only a few of those people that I knew at the time who stayed on for a military career. Interestingly enough, even today, I work with one of those guys at the place where I'm at right now. Somebody I met early in my career in the Army, and a few others that I still am in contact with who did stay on for military career.
Mm-hmm. And about how many of that 200 were male nurses in your class?
Well, certainly, I'd have to say that I don't remember specifically. So I would have to try to dig out the photo and count them, but. Right off the top of my head, I would have to say that at least 30 to 40 of them were.
Mm-hmm.
It was not an inconsequential number.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't 1 or 2 or 5 or 10. It was a pretty good number for the 200 in the class.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And were you guys kind of grouped together, housed together in quarters?
No, actually, men and women were quartered in the same building. The nurses were quartered separately. When I first got to Fort Sam, I ended up living in a tent, which wasn't very pleasant, for a week or two, because they didn't have enough rooms. But as other personnel moved out, we ended up all the nurses, male and female, living in the same building, although we were on different floors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what was basic training like? What kinds of things did you learn or do?
I guess... It's a hard question to answer. I think at the time it seemed exciting and informative and stuff. Today, I would have to say that probably a lot of it was not as beneficial as perhaps they wanted or would have liked. At the time, it differed, for example, from basic training for the enlisted personnel, for combat troops and stuff. It's really not like that. It's a much more cerebral, intellectual exercise. You got involved in instruction and chemical, nuclear, biological warfare stuff, you know, field exercises, those kinds of things. You spent out of the 8 weeks, I think we spent a week or so out at Camp Bullis, which was kind of a field training exercise. And it was kind of, you know, fun and different and exciting at the time. How beneficial it really was to my career down line, I can't really say, but I don't think it was as beneficial as they might have liked. Maybe they expected me to become more of a tactician and those kinds of things that are typical military traits. But clearly, I think I saw it, and I think most of my contemporaries saw it, as a kind of unique aspect to healthcare training that we really already had pretty much gone through. There were, in that basic course, there were not just nurses, there were also, of course, physicians and nutritionists and physical therapists, etc., because the various six Army medical departments were represented in each class.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority were nurses, but not all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we saw the basic experience as acculturating us to the military, learning how to salute, how to march, those kinds of things, so you would not embarrass yourself, but to say that you would have all that you would need to be a four-star general was also not the case.
And did you receive any kind of weapons training at all?
Yeah, there was familiarization training. Military at that time, and I suspect today, healthcare personnel are classified as non-combatants. So they don't have to qualify on a weapon, but most are asked to and do qualify for familiarization. You are not expected to be a combatant. Although, for example, when I went to Vietnam, there were some of us who were issued weapons for self-protection.
Mm-hmm.
But that I was never issued a weapon. I've never used a weapon. I don't personally have or own weapons. My only exposure to firing weapons were familiarization training in the military with both a 45 at that time, I guess it was an M1 rifle. Today it would be the AK-47, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And how was it decided who was issued weapons for self-defense?
It depended, I think, primarily on where people were going to and what the majors were.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it had anything more to do than that. I had a friend of mine, for example, when we left the compound, that when we first went into Vietnam, we got there the night Ted started, so there's a lot of stories there, but we were in the 90th Replacement Battalion for several days. When they started taking us out of there to go to our assignments, I was only going to an assignment that was only like a mile or two away from the 90th Replacement Battalion. I have a friend of mine who was an operating room nurse. He had to drive to Saigon in a Jeep, so he was issued a weapon for that ride and stuff. But he was a lot more familiar with weapons, and I know he had his own weapons and stuff. But I've never been attuned to using them. And except for the familiarization, I've never been issued them to use one in the military.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hmm. And then you said that once you had joined the military, you were already interested in the anesthesia program?
Yes.
And when did you get interested in that? Was that a nursing school?
Yeah, it was a nursing school. I found as I went through the nursing program, one of my first rotations was operating room. And the operating room was a 3-month rotation. Today, most nursing programs don't have any kind of rotation for operating room nursing. And that's too bad, because that's a major critical area. But at that time, it was a rotation. I found I really liked it. That was really kind of where I wanted to be. And so when I graduated in May. I was going on active duty with the Army in September, and I ended up working in the operating room for those 3 or 4 months over the summer. And so I pretty much always had my experiences and my love behind the swinging doors in the operating room. That to me is the area that I like the best. And it started way back then, and by that time, I had gotten some exposure to anesthesia. We only had 2 anesthesiologists, but I became aware that nurses were also doing anesthesia. That piqued my interest. I looked into it, and by the time I came on active duty, I knew I wanted to apply to the Army's program. At that time, the program was 1.5 years long. Today, it is a minimum of 2 years program, and in some cases, as long as 36 months. But in those days, it was already decided that was what I was going to shoot for, because that was the thing that excited me the most.
Mm-hmm. Did you really give a thought to what made you interested in that field in particular?
I can't say that I did, except that I guess I saw it as kind of the anesthesia is one of those things that you have to... it's very immediate. I guess that's the best way I can describe it. The decisions, et cetera, that have to be made quickly, and the responses that you get from your decisions tends to be also very quick. It is high-tech in a lot of ways, so that's kind of appealing, and that's one of the reasons I think there are more men in it that there are in any other nursing specialties, except maybe for psychiatry. I have to say that I didn't really think too much about it at the time, except that I saw it as an exciting and challenging area to be in, and that was kind of what most of my thinking went along, probably those lines at the time. There was no one else in my nursing school that I knew of who wanted to go into the specialty. I had not known any nurse anesthetist. A lot of times when you talk to people who become nurse anesthetists today, they'll tell you that they started getting interested when they worked with or watched a nurse anesthetist.
Mm-hmm.
I never had that experience.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it was more of an extension of the operating room. Now, that's not unusual today. Because of the requirement today for people to have a minimum of 1 to 2 years of ICU experience, intensive care unit experience, before they get into a nursing anesthesia program. In those days, there were no such things as intensive care units. They hadn't been developed yet.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of people who came into anesthesia came out from the operating room environment. So I was very typical of the kind of person who went in to anesthesia in those days. Now, the only thing that was probably substantially different was that I was much younger. I had gone off to college at about 17 or 18. I started the nursing program at, I guess, about 19 or 20. Finished up, and then when I graduated from my nursing anesthesia program, I was about 24. The average age for nursing anesthesia students at the time was about 27, 28. Today it's about 34, 35. So I was young even for the group that I was with at that time. And by comparison to most people who are my contemporaries in terms of age, I've been in anesthesia a lot longer than most for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you applied for the program while you were at Fort Sam, but then you were assigned to Walter Reed for a few months first. Is that right?
Correct. I came on active duty in September, went to Walter Reed at the end of October. The selections were still being made at that point, but the next class was not going to start until the next May, May of 66. And I was assigned initially to an officer's general surgical ward at Walter Reed, so it was primarily all officers who had undergone some kind of general surgery procedure. There were other people who got assigned to other wards, vascular ward, orthopedics, those kinds of things. But the program didn't start till the following May, and I think I was advised that I would be starting the program somewhere around February or so.
Mm-hmm. And did you like Walter Reed, your assignment there?
Oh, yeah. Loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in those days, much more so in many respects than even today, and I say today, the time that I retired from the Army, which is 1984, there was still a lot of cohesiveness, a kind of family feeling about the Army Medical Department as a whole, but also in particular the Army Nurse Corps. It was much more so, much more a family kind of environment. Hard to explain, I guess, but it was like all Army nurses are, you know, stick together and help each other kind of thing. When I first went in, we partied hardy. We worked hard. We partied hard. We did everything together, and there was a lot of camaraderie and stuff that I think, to some extent, was lost over the years, at least to some extent. I think it's still there, but not to the same extent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you were, at this point, still dating your wife, right? You weren't married yet.
At that point, I was still dating my wife, and I would come home periodically from Washington, D.C. To New Hampshire, and then go back, you know, after the weekend and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We had to decide whether or not we were going to get married before I went to Vietnam or after I went to Vietnam, etc. We elected to get married before I went to Vietnam. So we got married about 6 months before I graduated. We got married in April of 67. I graduated from the program in November, end of November of 67, went on leave, and then in January of 68, went to Vietnam, and by that time my wife was pregnant. We debated about whether I should get a deferral until the baby was born. The baby wasn't scheduled to be born for a while yet, so decided I would go, and it would probably be in the long run best if I came back, you know, came back sooner, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
When I arrived home from Vietnam, it was my daughter's 11th month birthday. So,
mm-hmm.
And whether it worked out okay or not, I would think today that it did, but I've always been concerned that maybe there was something missed out on there that would have been better if we'd done things the other way around, but you can't go back.
Mm-hmm. And you said there were 5 people who applied for your program? From
the program at Walter Reed. Again, in those days, the Army's program was actually 6 different programs. Today, it's one program with multiple clinical sites. So everybody today would be in the same academic class at Fort Sam, but would be farmed out for their clinical experiences in different places. In those days, everybody took their academics and their clinical on site at 106 different places. So the 7 people who came on active, who started the nurse anesthesia program with me, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of us. 5 of the 7 were out of that basic class that I was with at Fort Sam. 2 of the others were people who had already served some time on active duty as Army nurses.
Mm-hmm.
One of those eventually dropped out of the program, and the rest of us all finished the program, and 1, 2, 3 at least of the remainder spent at least a 20-year career in the Army.
Mm-hmm. And how many were men and how many were women?
At the time that I started the program, we had 4 men and 3 women.
Mm-hmm.
One of those guys, the one who didn't finish the program, is now deceased. One of them got out after his tour in Vietnam. Another one stayed in the Army for a while and then got out and went to work for National Institutes of Health. I stayed on for the military for a 20-year career in, I think the other one also stayed for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And what about the women? Did they stay in generally, or did they get out?
Yeah, let's see. One of the women was in a career mode and ended up dying of cancer before she got out of the military. The other two completed 20 years and retired.
Hmm. And you said you did your anesthesia program at Walter Reed?
Yes.
Okay. I think Bill Story and some other guys had done theirs in San Francisco at Letterman.
Correct.
I think. Okay. So that was one of the other areas you could do it.
The sites at the time were at Fort Sam Houston at Brooke Army Medical Center, Walter Reed in Washington, D.C., Tacoma, Washington at Madigan Army Medical Center, Letterman at San Francisco, Denver, Fitzsimmons at Colorado, Denver, Colorado, and Tripler Army Medical Center in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. And did you request to stay at Walter Reed, or was that just kind of where you were assigned? Was that the luck of the draw, or?
I suspect that was, it was, my guess is that it was probably just convenience and economics. Once I got accepted to the program, it was easier to keep the five of us at Walter Reed because we were already there than to move us to another location.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly how that happened, I don't know, but my guess is, at the time, my program director was the consultant for Army nurse anesthetist. I would have had a say in who went where. So maybe those decisions for other people were already made. And we had already expressed, the five of us expressed an interest in going to Walter Reed because we had had, we could submit a request for where our first assignments were, and that was irrespective of the nursing anesthesia program. We'd all signed up for Walter Reed, and we'd all signed up for the nursing anesthesia program. So since we were already there, it probably just made sense to keep us there for the program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And was this, you said it's half kind of book work and then half clinical, is that right?
Well, I don't know about the half and half. In those days, the program, the academic and the clinical aspects of the program were both on the same site. For the first 4 months, we spent all day, every day in class. After that, we ended up having class time around clinical. So we would spend most of the day, every day, Monday through Friday, in the clinical area, and then have classes, usually starting at about 3:30 or 4 in the afternoon, and run until about 5 or 6 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And we would do that every day.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough way to go. The nursing anesthesia programs, as is true for a lot of clinical programs in healthcare, have to accommodate both the academics and clinical, and that's tough to do. And so you have different approaches that are used. Today, most nursing anesthesia programs will either be concurrent programs, which is what I just described, where you take academics and clinical at the same time, or they'll be what are called front-loaded programs, where the student goes in and spends all the first year in class and then goes into nothing but straight clinical. And they both both ways have their advantages and disadvantages. The guys who go to front-loaded program kind of have to relearn a lot of stuff the second year because it's been a while since they've thought about it. The concurrent program is very good, I think, for people who learn by doing because you get to immediately apply what you've learned in the classroom in the clinical setting. So they both have their advantages and disadvantages. A terrible disadvantage to the folks in the concurrent program is that it makes for very long days and very high mm-hmm. stress while you're in the program.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you're dealing with 12 or 15-hour days pretty much every day for that intense period of time in a high-stress specialty, it's difficult to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And let's see, at what point did you get your orders for Vietnam?
I got my orders for Vietnam before I graduated. I want to say it was probably October of 67, might have been a little bit earlier or later, but that's about the correct date. There was enough time for me to know before I graduated that I was going to be going there so that my wife and I could plan, and one of the decisions we had to make was whether she was going to stay in the D.C. area or come back home to New Hampshire while I was in Vietnam, and she elected to come home with her folks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what did you think about the war at that point?
Well, that's an interesting question. I didn't think about the war in terms of, at that time, I didn't think about it in terms that a lot of people would describe as, I guess, contrast. I didn't see it as a battle between good and evil or something that people were really opposed to. I tended to see, I guess, people who opposed the war at that time as being in the minority. Again, I'd grown up, you know, pretty much a post-World War II baby. And I think more than not, it was my country, kind of right or wrong, and that in terms of defending the country, that's always the right thing to do. So I tended to see the war as, if not something right of itself, I thought that my role in it, in terms of supporting the troops from America and America itself, as being the right thing to do, was probably pretty much how I felt about it. It wasn't until much later, well after I came back from Vietnam, probably actually closer to the end of the Vietnam War, 73-74, that I really began to appreciate how divergent the views about the Vietnam War were and how divisive it had really been to the country. At the time that I got my orders and the time that I went there, I thought it was my obligation to do and to do my best in fulfilling my role as a mercenary in support of military operations. I didn't question that very much. I certainly didn't see it as wrong. I still today don't see my part in the war as wrong. I felt that my role in trying to keep people alive who were our troops was a good thing, and I still think it's a good thing. On the other hand, there clearly were some very real questions about the politics and policy that led to the war and sustained the war that I think people later questioned, that I was not on board questioning until much, much later.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of, now looking back on it, can see a separation between the questions of whether the war, you know, right or wrong, or...
Yeah, and I, you know, and of course, as I'm sure you're aware, a lot of people are seeing, again, a lot of similarities between the Vietnam War and the Iraqi War, mm-hmm. in terms of supporting the troops and trying to do what's right with regards to our soldiers and airmen and stuff is different than whether we are fighting the right war for the right purpose, etc. I think people today are much more sophisticated about those things. They question more, and they're more apt to be divergent in their views about whether or not the war is right versus whether supporting our troops is right or wrong. I think most people still contend that supporting the troops is a good thing to do. They're probably not as sure about whether the war is worthwhile or not.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, I found that a lot of, regardless of, you know, what people thought of the war then or now, that the health care aspect of that was always separate. You know, that regardless whether you supported the war or not, that
yeah.
the health care role was...
The question that I noticed in your questionnaire was, how were you treated when you came back from the war? I came back right after the 10 of 69, and I experienced some of the... I was told not to wear my uniform. I was certainly jeered and scorned when I landed in California and was waiting a plane back to the East Coast. So I did run across that. I mean, the only way they could tell me from an infantry troop would have been to look at my medical insignia, and most people were not sophisticated enough to do that. So to them, anybody in uniform was a bad guy, and I got some of that, and nowhere near, I'm sure, what some other people got, but I certainly was derided and treated to some extent with scorn when I first came back. I guess I expected it by then because it had already been written about, but in terms of my personal experience, I didn't let that bother me too much because I knew that what I had done, I didn't have to feel ashamed or embarrassed about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you got your orders for the war, were you, I mean, was that something that made you very nervous? Were you scared about your safety or any of those concerns once you got your orders?
Only in a general sense. Well, first of all, I moved from the time that I started my nurse anesthesia program, while you were in the military, even though you were in a training program, it was very clear. I mean, we get reports back all the time. We get the patients back from the war zones. I mean, you heard first-person stories about what was going on in the war. And so we knew right from the get-go that we were going to be going to Vietnam. In fact, all but one person in my class went to Vietnam right after. One person was assigned to Japan. But the rest of us went to Vietnam. We knew right from the onset that that was where we were likely to go. So when the orders came down, it was no big surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really kind of what we anticipated. Was there a fear? I think only in a general sense.
Mm-hmm.
Fear of the unknown. I probably, if I had to go back to a war zone today, I would probably be less worried than I am, or I was at that time. I think there's something to be said for having been through the experience once, that at least you have a little bit better sense of what you're going to have to get into. So it wasn't that. What probably worried me the most was for my wife and at that time unborn daughter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you received your orders in October, and you got married right around that time?
No, we were married.
You'd been married, okay.
6 months beforehand in April.
Okay. Okay, and so you said that because your wife was pregnant, you could have asked for a deferment?
Correct.
Uh-huh. And would they have just given you a deferment until the baby was born?
Right.
Okay.
It's likely that they would have until the baby was born.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I probably still would have had to go. And so we debated, do I want to be, do we want her to be 2 years old before I get back, or do we not? And yeah, we elected to go and hope that everything worked out. As it turned out, my daughter was born substantially early. Both of my kids were. So my daughter was actually born 3 weeks after I got to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And how did you hear about her birth? Did you not find out until later? Were you able to get a call through the Red Cross?
About 24 or so hours later through a Red Cross message.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Okay, and you said you arrived, at the first night of Tet 68. So what was that like, arriving in the country at that moment?
Well, let me back up a little bit.
Okay.
I was scheduled to leave, I think it was on somewhere around the 25th of January. I left, I was home on leave in New Hampshire with my wife and my family. Left out of the Boston airport, flew to San Francisco, because I was going to be flying out of Oakland on a military flight. And I had like a day or so layover there. Then I reported in, and we were put on a transport plane out of Oakland, and a stopover in Hawaii. And they were supposed to have a stopover in Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines. Because of plane trouble, we ended up staying in the Philippines for I think it was another 2 days. So we got to Vietnam actually a little bit later than had been the original intent. That is, if it had not been for the delays, probably would have been there a day or two sooner.
Mm-hmm.
When we arrived at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and we landed at Longbin Air Force Base, which is about 16 miles north of Saigon. It was under intense fire. At that time, none of us on the plane knew about what was going on. In fact, most people at that point didn't know. The fighting for Tet of 68, which is considered the worst fighting in the war, started about an hour before we landed. And it's my understanding, although I don't have it confirmed, that ours was one of the last, if not the last, plane into Vietnam for about 4 days because of the intensity of the fighting. We were roughly 210 people on my plane, if I recall correctly. We were all unloaded along with our baggage in about 10 or 15 minutes onto armored carriers, to take us to the replacement battalion. But the plane was being fired upon as we landed, and it was easy to see the tracer bullets and stuff. the plane, you know, came down fast on a steep angle, stayed on the ground, kept the motors running, dumped everything, and was back in the air very, very quickly. By then, we were loaded onto buses or armored personnel carriers to take us to the 90th replacement. We got there, and it was obvious that there was intense fighting going on. So even though we had already been up a couple of days, nobody was going to get any sack time. We were staying in either tents or in what are called Adams huts or Quonset huts.
Mm-hmm.
There were metal kinds of buildings. I'm sure you've seen them or something.
Mm-hmm.
Adams huts are basically an aluminum kind of house that kind of is like a Quonset hut. So we were housed there. We were in buildings that basically opened out onto a field to the other end of the compound, and there was intense fighting going on between our troops and the Viet Cong advancing. So it was very easy to see the fire exchange between the two of them. We were basically made to lie on the floor. We were not issued weapons, interestingly enough. So the best we got was to put a pillow over our heads. But we landed, like I said, about 3. One of the people that I came in with, although not in my building, but a major who was about 34 years old, as I recall, ended up taking a bullet through the heart at about 8 o'clock in the morning, getting shot from this crossfire that was going on behind the compound. As the daylight hours came up, the fighting kind of leveled off. The Viet Cong disappeared into the night, and although there continued to be intense fighting over the next couple of days, that fighting didn't seem to occur as much where I was at. But nobody got to leave the compound for about 4 days, and the first people out were nurses. There was myself, one of my classmates, Sally McNamara, Bill Pewitt, who was an OR nurse that I referred to earlier. We were the first ones out of there. Bob Pewitt went down to Saigon, the 3rd Field Hospital. Sally McNamara went up to Kuchi, which was 12th and back. And there was another guy whose name I don't remember right at the moment. It was somebody that I knew. And myself went to the 24th and back. And we got there, met the chief nurse. I was taken over to the operating room. I was handed a couple of syringes of pentothal and said, and the person who was the chief nurse in essence was Norma Horsley. She handed me 2 syringes of pentothal and said, there's a patient. Give me a call if you need anything. That was it. That was my introduction. So I went into the room and not knowing where anything was or anything more, did cases for the next 19 hours. The fighting during Tet was extremely intense. Within a couple of days, we had numerous bodies lined up outside on the sidewalk walkway between the Quonset hut buildings with people who were either awaiting surgery or who had already died. So it was a tremendous, amount of fighting in the region and large numbers of casualties. It wasn't until many days later that we found out how bad things had been during Tet of 68 and how many people had been killed. But I can tell you that at one point they were taking bodies off in what are called deuce and a half or 2.5 ton trucks in pretty large numbers. And we were extremely busy around the clock for almost 3 weeks before things started to settle down. I still remember in about 2.5-3 weeks out finally being able to go to the mess hall with some kind of leisure, instead of just running in and grabbing a bite, sitting down and having one of the nurses who had been there probably 8 or 9 or 10 months at that time, ask me how long we'd been there. And I said, you know, it's only been 3 weeks. And she thought it was considerably more because things had been so intense in that few weeks of time. I later went through a couple of other heavy engagements of fighting, but nothing as bad as when I first came into the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so your kind of welcome to Vietnam was rather rushed.
Rather rushed.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was. In fact, the gal who was my chief nurse anesthetist, I later saw again. She's retired now. In fact, she's not in good health anymore. Norma Horsley lives in Washington State, and I have a friend who is a good friend of hers who saw her late last year. But she was a very no-nonsense kind of person, and at that time she was extremely busy, very short-staffed, and so when the two of us got there, we were a big help, but they didn't realize or appreciate that at the time because they didn't have time to really get to know us or meet us or give us an orientation or anything. They just had to give us the equipment and hope for the best.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, she worried about that at the time.
Uh-huh. And so you landed at the and were sent to the 90th replacement and then sent to the 24th evac, which is all the same area, right? And
correct.
We knew that was under attack from when you landed. So were you concerned about that, that you were being assigned to a hostile area?
I can't say that I was. And you know, later, I came to appreciate how relatively safe I was compared to people who were assigned elsewhere in country. Clearly, there were more dangerous assignments. Although I have to say, in those first few weeks, we did end up, you know, with people who were injured or killed nearby, and/or who where we had shells and stuff that went over our position and stuff. But I can't say that we really had many other of our people killed in the immediate vicinity. I had friends that were sent, up north, where the fighting was a lot more intense and there was much less protection for them. So I can't say that I had it worse than anybody else. It's just that I don't think any of us appreciated the intensity of fighting during Tet of 68. We'd never really experienced anything like that before. And because we didn't know it, I mean, you kind of imagine when you're on your way to Vietnam at that time, what's it going to be like? How bad is the fighting going to be? Am I going to be near it? And all those things cross your mind. But because I didn't know any better,
mm-hmm.
what I experienced for those first few weeks is kind of wow, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't surprise or scare me, but the thought that crossed my mind is, can I put up with a year of this?
Yeah.
It wasn't until, like I said, 2 or 3 weeks later, things settled down, that I got some appreciation for how bad things had really been, but I just didn't know any better. None of us did, who had been there before.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all the people that I knew at that time were fresh in the country, had no prior combat experience, and it's just kind of what it got to be what we thought it had to be, and it wasn't until much later we realized how significantly worse it was than the average kind of pace of work during the war. There were two or three other major battle campaigns in the year that I was there. None of them, as bad as they were as equivalent to those first couple of weeks. So I guess I walked into it, got hit with the worst of it in those first couple of weeks, and things were never quite as bad again.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, I thought, this is not going to be a fun way to spend a year.
Uh-huh. And how did the rest of the year compare to that? I mean, in terms of your workload or how much you had to do compared to those 3 weeks?
Workload, you have to understand the 24th evac was a 200-bed evacuation-sized hospital,
mm-hmm.
not a combat surgical hospital, which is like 60 beds at that time. It's much more mobile. We were kind of basically a permanent fixture in Quonset huts. We were basically a referral center for maxillofacial and neurosurgery. And we did about 85% of those cases for Vietnam. So even when other places weren't busy, we were generally going to be busy still working on folks that have been evacuated into our facility. For the most part, the workload tended to vary. When it got busy, when there was a lot of fighting and stuff, you could be very busy for several days around the clock. Then there were other times when it was just really very quiet. You didn't do anything for a day or two. For the most part, we would do, I said for the most of the year that I was there, we'd be doing moderate level business on a day-to-day basis. And then when things got hot, the workload went up considerably.
Mm-hmm. And did you work 12-hour shifts?
The staffing at various hospitals was tremendously individualized based on the number of people there and the workload they had to support.
Mm-hmm.
At the time that I was there, we had roughly 9 or 10 nurse anesthetists, and depending on the time of the year, we had 2 to 4 anesthesiologists. We basically had a rotating schedule. That is, everybody was on every day in terms of technically being on the schedule, but you would go from first person on, which meant you pretty much were going to work the whole 24 hours, a little less if you were the second guy. Once you get down to it, but we had 6 rooms, so once you got to be the 7th or 8th guy, you weren't probably going to be doing cases per se.
Mm-hmm.
You were still expected to get up out of bed from your sleep from the day before to come in and give lunch reliefs and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So once you came off your free day, then you'd be back on the first on the schedule, and so you'd probably work 24 hours again. it worked pretty well because it kept your best rested people available to do the work and gave you some time off so you didn't get killed. One of the big mistakes that people make over and over again in a combat or emergency situation is to commit all their people around the clock initially. And in about 72 hours, everybody's burned out. You can't get anything done. You got to close down. We didn't have to do that because we kept our people relatively fresh. I mean, it's not fun if you've been working 24 hours. You get to bed at 7 a.m. and at 12 o'clock, you got to get up and go give folks lunch relief. And then go back to bed from, say, 1 to 5. But that's what we did, and it generally worked out pretty well. I mean, nobody complained about it, and it was very equitable, and we didn't have any problems. The only time there was a problem, I remember one day, we had some new people in who'd been there for like a day or two, and things had been relatively quiet. We had an officers' club, and so that was a place to gather at and drink and eat pizza and sandwiches. Those kinds of things. So this particular day, they were going to have a welcoming party for these new people who had just arrived that week. And 2 or 3 of those were people who were on the call schedule to come in if anything was going on. And nothing was going on at the time. So about 7 p.m., the party started. And long about 8:30 o'clock, they'd already been drinking a little bit, and they shouldn't have been, but they were. And then in Saigon, they started a bombing run that ended up with, the building 16 miles away here shaking as the 500-pound bombs were being dropped. And what happened was those 2 or 3 people who were supposed to have been on the call roster that day ended up getting smashed out of their minds because they were so scared. That the rest of us who had already come off duty for 24 or so hours had to go back and cover it the rest of that night. But that's the only incident like that. They got a reading the next day and said, don't pull that again, guys. And we never had any more problems after that.
Mm-hmm. Would there have been any instance where those guys who had had a little too much may have been called into work, or would that have ever happened?
Oh, I suspect it probably happened, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of us did not drink when we were on call because we knew the possible consequences, but I would not for a minute think that everybody did that.
I think that this
was their first opportunity to, quote, party, I guess. They've been in country a couple of days. I suspect they were probably still somewhat depressed. They probably did it figuring, it's okay, there's nothing pending and going on, and a drink isn't going to hurt me. But when they started hearing those bombs and feeling the building shake and the dust drop down on them from the rafters, I think they tended to have another one and another one, and before long it was a problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what were your housing quarters like there?
When I first got to 24th, I was in a tent for about, 2 weeks, I think. And then I got a room in a Adams hut. Basically an open aluminum building with slatted sides and there were probably six or eight rooms to them. There were central outdoor privies and a central outdoor shower, and everything else was in these Quonset hut-like Adams hut. I was located near, probably about 20 feet away from the fence for the 50th Med Battalion, which was the prison compound for the prisoners in the area, that is the combat prisoners. The combat prisoners were basically North Vietnamese troops and Viet Cong irregulars, and they were housed in a facility that was pretty close to where we slept. In addition to that, there was an American compound prison about two blocks away, one or two blocks away from us, that housed American troops who had been arrested and charged with various crimes and stuff. The reason I mention that is in November of the year that I was there, which a lot of people don't remember, there was a big riot at that prison. They essentially burned it to the ground. All the troops, all the prisoners got loose. It took them a long time to round them up. Some of them ended up at the hospital with us, along with some of the guards, and people were running around with loaded weapons on the hospital compound, which is not something that normally happens. We got a large number of casualties that were seriously injured from that riot at the prison. But that was diffused in about 24 hours, and most of those people were rounded up in security.
Mm-hmm. And the people running around the hospital with the weapons, were they
Hard to tell.
Okay.
I think the vast majority of them were probably guards or MPs who had legitimate, who were looking for the troops. But one of the things they were obviously concerned about was that some of those prisoners could have melded into the patient population and not been discovered very readily.
Uh-huh.
I think that was their concern. I don't know whether that happened. I can tell you that we handled several hundred casualties in a matter of hours, but most of them, fortunately, could be handled in the emergency room or a ward area under local anesthesia for their lacerations and the like. And only a few people ended up actually having to come to the operating room, but those who did were very seriously injured.
And so your housing was mainly with other male nurses or the physicians or?
The male quarters area was everybody. That is, we had some huts that were dedicated to the enlisted personnel. Those that were officers quarters were the male nurses, doctors, PT, OT, whatever else was there. The females had their own quarters. Again, there was a mix. The vast majority there were probably nurses because we didn't have, at that time, very much in the way of female physicians. I can't remember one right now. But we would have had some dietitians and some other people like that that would have been in the nurses' quarters as well.
And how were relations between the doctors and the nurses?
Very good. I think for the most part, again, it was not a question of difficult relations because of either gender or because of branch. I don't think it was a doctor-nurse thing. It was more apt to be a personality kind of thing. There were clearly a couple of people on both ends of the spectrum, doctors or nurses, that just couldn't get along well with other folks.
Were there ever any kind of big incidents or any real problems with that, with people?
Once or twice. There were a couple of slugfests that occurred. I don't know what more to tell you about that. Basically a situation where you have people working in a high-stress environment in a limited, confined situation, and, annoyances get to verbal exchanges, and verbal exchanges move on to physical exchanges and stuff. So there were a couple of, push and shoving, punching matches, but they were relatively short-lived, and they went on. Clearly, I think there were a couple of people that I remember that were generally pretty well disliked because of either their attitude or their personalities or unwillingness to work on it as a team and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But that tended to be rare and really not very very much a problem. Interestingly enough, I don't know that there were or were not similar problems in the enlisted ranks. I just never had the opportunity to be in a situation where I would have seen these changes between the enlisted people. One of the big problems, as I'm sure you're probably aware, is that in that kind of situation, alcohol gets to be a crutch for a lot of folks.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there were a couple of people, both physicians and enlisted and nurses, who drank heavily in that period of time. And in fact, I have to say that probably, relatively speaking, everybody drank more heavily than they would in any other time in their lives. But I know one individual, for example, who was knocking off a couple of fifths a day. That's a pretty, and given his work, you would think that that would not have been the case. This was a guy who did all of the sterilizers. Now, if you work with operating room sterilizers, this guy was a surgeon, if you work with that kind of equipment, it's already 120 degrees, you know, in the atmosphere, weather-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy was operating sterilizers that probably increased the steam and heat level another 40-50% easily. I mean, it was just a tough area to work in that kind of environment. And this guy drank
mm-hmm.
very, very heavily. He didn't drink on duty, but boy, when he was off, he sure drank. You know, and that's too bad. And I have to say that there were a couple of physicians and stuff who, again, didn't drink on duty, but that I'm aware of. But who, when they party hardy.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And how was morale in general throughout the year?
I'd have to say that overall morale was pretty good. Again, there's a tremendous, at least for healthcare people working in a hospital kind of environment, I think the general sense was that we were there for, you know, for the right reasons. That is, what we were doing was worthwhile, taking care of the troops and stuff. That we were, that we worked well as a team. There really was, I think one of the things that people don't appreciate about a war zone kind of situation, probably even true today in Iraq, is that everybody, to be effective in that kind of environment for healthcare folks, everybody has to move up a notch. I mean, there were things all of us did in Vietnam that we would never, ever have the opportunity to do here in a civilian sector, simply because it was required and there just weren't enough bodies to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think so many enlisted people came back from Vietnam and went into either medicine or nursing, because they had been challenged and met the mark, so to speak, in so many different ways in their jobs in Vietnam that they really got tuned into a healthcare career. The whole physician assistant thing started as a result of those enlisted people coming back from Vietnam and looking to take up a role in healthcare. Today we accept them, but in those days there wasn't any such thing as physician assistant. That all started post-Vietnam. So I think the morale overall was very, very good. I think individually people would have their depressive periods. I mean, it's tough to be in an environment that you are locked into for such a long period of time. It isn't like you can go down to a local ball game or movie theater and say, you know, I'm going to kill the afternoon and I'll feel better by going to a movie. It just didn't work that way. I mean, you were always on call. You were always subject to some kind of an attack. One of the things that, I don't know if I mentioned this to you previously when we talked, but one of the big differences I noticed is when I came back from Vietnam, I got a lot of invitations from veterans groups to join them, VFW, MVETS, etc.
Mm-hmm.
You'll notice that today most of those organizations are crumbling because they don't have any new members. They have very, very few from Vietnam. And it's because I think that, just like what happened to me, I get invited by a couple of people who had been my father's contemporaries during World War II, who had joined veterans organizations and he knew them still, and they still held around together. Who asked me, well, you know, you come back from Vietnam, why don't you join us, you know, and I would be given these offers. And it was clear from talking to these individuals that they didn't have a clue about how different the Vietnam War was compared to what had happened to them in World War II. World War II, up until World War II, combat was largely on the same ball. That is, there were the bad guys on one side, the fighting area in the middle, and the good guys on the other side. And if you came back 20 or 30 miles from the fighting line, you were pretty safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where people went for R&R, rest and relaxation. But in Vietnam, that wasn't the case. You couldn't go anywhere without the possibility of being attacked.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, I remember that there were a number of people killed in Saigon from attacks that were basically a bomb under some four-year-old girl's dress that would, you know, she would get on a bus and make sure, you know, everybody's blown up. Now, in those days, that was radically new and different. It was the first time, I think, American troops experienced that level of guerrilla warfare. Today, we see the same thing to a much higher level in Iraq and in other parts of the world. Clearly, people have no real appreciation for what guerrilla warfare can do. And one of the things that it does is it's psychologically defeating. It is that constant threat that no matter where you go, what you do, who you associate with, you might suffer death or disability from somebody who is out to attack you, and there's no way to protect yourself. So a lot of people, I think, in the post-Vietnam, a lot of GIs and stuff, did not join veterans groups because they didn't see those groups as either understanding or appreciate what they've gone through. I think I see that continuing today with the post-Vietnam, post-Iraqi war troops. They, even perhaps more than the Vietnam troops, have experienced a level of guerrilla warfare that is probably unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to continue to have a big impact on everyone.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess with the year in general, you kind of start off with Tet. It's kind of the height of the whole war in general. And then how did the rest of the year compare? What kinds of things do you remember from the year?
There are, like I say, I think everybody's experience is somewhat defined by the time that they're there. There were essentially four major campaigns while I was there. Four or five major campaigns while I was there. Campaigns being where there was a specified fighting period where that was much higher than the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably only true for people who were in Vietnam at the time that I was. That is, if you went to Vietnam before or after, in a one-year tour, there were never again as many campaigns of fighting. So we did have our busy periods. I remember the May offensive. There was a November offensive. So there were those kinds of periods when things got very, very busy. But again, the experience with Tet of 68 when I landed there and first came into the 24th was so different and so much more intense that things were just never as bad again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've thought to myself over the years, what if I had been in Vietnam 6 months before Tet?
Mm-hmm.
How would I have reacted to Tet? Because I certainly, at that point, then would have recognized how bad all of a sudden things got.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have that opportunity. For me, it was the instant reality, and I dealt with it, but I didn't recognize till much later how bad it really was. If I had been there 6 months before, I'm sure I would have recognized it as being really bad, and I don't know what that would have done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do you think you dealt with the year?
I think I dealt with the year very well.
Mm-hmm.
I'll get you to probably the most important point that I would like to make in this interview.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big post-Vietnam problems was the development of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And it became, it's a big issue. It was a big issue after Vietnam. It continues to be a big issue with the Iraqi war. My personal feeling on that is that a large portion of post-traumatic stress disorder for a lot of people is a function of what they were like before they went to Vietnam. It isn't so much a function of what their experiences were in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But there are two categories. I think there are for the combat troops, those people who saw their buddies blown away and stuff, I think the trauma of that did create psychological problems for a large number of these people. But for those people, especially non-combatants, who have so-called post-traumatic stress disorder, I think a large number of them were unable to cope or didn't cope well with their lives and were not really prepared to go to Vietnam. That is, they should have recognized how bad injuries and trauma and stuff are in a combat zone, and yet they seem never to have really caught on to that.
Mm-hmm.
My personal feeling is that those people I personally knew who claimed to have post-traumatic stress disorder after the war were people who were kind of kooky and not well put together before the war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are people who would disagree with that, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you that there are a fair number of people who were Vietnam veterans that I know of who've gone on to be very successful people. They coped. They continue to cope. They don't have all these hidden problems. And the reason they do is because they went into the thing knowing and being wide-eyed about what kind of an experience it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't anything I saw or dealt with in Vietnam that I didn't think I was prepared to deal with when I went there. My experiences in training, my wife and I have talked about this over the years, and we think the kind of training that we had gave us a very good ability to not only recognize but to cope with those levels of trauma. But I have to say that I think that really is true only for a few people. The large number of people, they really weren't well prepared for what they were going to experience in a combat zone. I think that probably is still true today. Again, it's probably a minority position. But those people who went to Vietnam that I know of who were very, had a good idea of what they were going to get themselves into, have continued to function after Vietnam, have done very well. They're, you know, in positions of leadership and stuff. And they're not going around worrying about the kinds of things that some of these people who claim PDA, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder have. Again, that's a minority view, but it's one that I wanted to get across.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that people really appreciate the number of people who came out of Vietnam, probably stronger than when they went in, but who went in with an ability to cope that I think was probably above average.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that staying in the military can help with that as well?
Possibly. I don't know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that that's not an unreasonable position.
Mm-hmm.
That again, that the longer you are in the military, probably some of that gets reinforced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Part because I guess that if you look at the military structure compared to a civilian employment setting, it's you have to be able to cope in order to really progress in the military. You know, the old adage is up or out, you know.
Uh-huh.
That if you're going to get promoted, you want to get promoted, if you're a career individual, you've got to undergo at least one evaluation a year, sometimes as many as four or five performance evaluations a year. You have to meet certain requirements in order to move up. That's probably a much more competitive environment than is true in most civilian sectors. And given that, if you stay successfully for 20 years, you probably are going to be the kind of individual who can cope with those stresses and manage one's life despite the restrictions. And I guess that's kind of what I'm saying, is that there are those people who were able to do that going to Vietnam who continue to do it after Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess after all of this, kind of this discussion of PTSD and all of that, did you ever have, you know, the dreams or the flashbacks or any of that?
Never once.
Never once. Did you ever you know, have dreams about the year that weren't, you know, nightmarish or anything like that?
Never. ever.
Wow, that's interesting.
That's why I make my point. And I recognize that it may be a minority position, but I know at least several people who I think feel pretty much along the same way. I think they have kind of gotten short shrift from those people who feel that it was all a trauma to them. I'm not saying that, that everybody who gets into a war zone situation as a soldier or as somebody else can't cope. I guess my whole point would be that we can do a better job of preparing people and teaching them about what they're realistically going to have to deal with, and that if we were able to do that very well, we could do a lot to influence the incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder in people who have served in a war zone. But again, that's not the majority position.
And do you think that youth has anything to do with that as well?
In terms of how...
how you respond to the experience in general and then kind of respond to it for years to come, I guess.
Well, only in the sense, I mean, my wife, like I say, and I have discussed this on a periodic basis. One of the things that happened to us, we've been married, we got married in 67. At the time my daughter was born, my son was born in 1970 when I'd been back from Vietnam about a year and a half, I guess, at that point. We got into a downward spin. I mean, we had like about 3-4 years, maybe more, of really bad luck. I mean, we just had a really difficult period. There were problems with my son's birth. My son is mentally retarded. He clearly had a lot of difficulties. My wife my wife spent the last 6 weeks or so of that pregnancy lying in bed, head down, with IV alcohol running in an effort to preserve the pregnancy, et cetera. It happened just as she started to. She went in for her physical exam before we were moving to New Hampshire because I just was getting reassigned to go back to school for my degree. That was in 1970, fall of 1970. And then we bought a house that turned out to be a disaster. The guy who sold it to us just went around. He wanted to extend living there before we could move in. I couldn't afford to let him do that. So I basically told him no. And before he left the house, he went around with a hammer and smashed walls out and stuff. It was a disaster. Then we had a car that got to be very problematic. I was going to school full time. My wife continued to have some health problems. It just went on and on and on for a long time, several years. It was far and away the worst period in our lives. But when we came out of it, I think we both said we're in a much better position to cope with our lives. And I think both of us today feel there's nothing you're going to throw at us that we can't cope with. I guess that's kind of what I was getting to before. That if you are that kind of person that you feel that you can deal with and cope with and anticipate the kinds of things that you're about to run into in combat zone or other high stress zones, that you can probably make it through. And I think a lot of people haven't done the credit for it. I'm not encouraging those people who did make it through, but I do think that we can do things. I mean, to make things better and reduce the incidence of people who develop stress from being put in those combat or other stress situations.
Yeah, I found there's, you know, there seems to be a wide gap between people who have had problems and people who haven't. That there's not really even a middle ground.
I agree with you. I don't think there really is a middle ground. I have tended to see very big disparities. One group who's done very well, they're not taking drugs, they're not alcoholics, they succeeded in going back to school, they succeeded in their jobs, they've raised their families, their kids don't have any problems, versus the group who just kind of came back and, you know, sits on the lawn in New Haven and demonstrates and says, woe is me, you know. I'm not saying that those people don't have real problems. They may indeed have. But it makes me wonder what their abilities were beforehand to cope with those stresses of war, and why we either didn't pick up or help them pick up on it and help them before they went, or why we've done such a poor job after they've come back of helping them get back on the straight path.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, there are still some people suffering the ill effects of that war 35, 40 years out. And I'm not quite sure why that is, although clearly some people claim that that was true for even the World War II vets, of which there are still a few around.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you, I mean, I gave a talk not too long ago to the local chapter of the Medal of Honor Society. In fact, it was the first chapter set up for the Medal of Honor. And gave a talk to those folks, and there are people there. They're almost all in their 70s and 80s, including some who were at Pearl Harbor and stuff. And they're all people who coped. They are all people who did very well. It's not that they weren't impacted by the stresses. They were.
Mm-hmm.
They dealt with it. And today, it seems that people don't do that as well as their forefathers did, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You think that the homecoming kind of reception had anything to do with that?
I don't know. I would tend to, if I had to bet, I'd say probably little to nothing was impacted by the homecoming. I mentioned earlier that I too was berated when I came back from Vietnam and ran into some of those familiar demonstrations. But I didn't let it bother me. And again, I think it was a function of your ability to cope more than what the actual stresses were. The fact that some of these guys experienced derogatory remarks and such directed at them when they came back from Vietnam nobody really cheered the troops who came back from World War II that much at the time they came back. Today, they are getting their just due. But both World War II and Korean vets will tell you that nobody was out there waving the flag when they came back. They were just glad to be back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And somehow, things after the Vietnam War started going in a different direction. And I'm not sure why, except that I see it all as part and parcel of a general, seems in some ways growing, inability of a lot of young people to really master their own lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And did you run into any of the, I guess you were there kind of at a big year in terms of the war and the home front and what was happening at home. And did you run into any anti-war demonstrations in Long Bend, or did you see any kind of ramifications of that? Or?
No. All of that was after I landed. There were demonstrators. I recall demonstrators. I don't know if they were actually demonstrating, whether they just happened to be there and,
mm-hmm.
and made pack rocks. There were a number of people who landed with me in California when I came back from Vietnam. We had to go from the military terminal in Oakland to San Francisco airport to catch a trip to flight. I was going to stop off and visit my brother in Louisiana before proceeding home to New Hampshire, just because it was logistically more convenient to do that than to come home first.
Mm-hmm.
So I was waiting for a flight on the commercial airlines at that airport. There were a number of other people in uniform because we'd all just come into Vietnam and all had to have uniforms at that point. And before I was going home, I also had to stop in Washington, D.C. To talk to the people in my branch career office about my next assignment. So I was going from Louisiana to Washington, D.C. To New Hampshire. And the person that I talked to in D.C., who I had known at Walter Reed before I was a student, actually, when I worked on the wards, was now the career person, and she told me, don't wear your uniform. For the rest of the way, and the time that you're on leave, you're just asking for trouble. But at the time that I landed in California, I certainly had an arm, and I ran into some people who made comments and derogatory comments and stuff. And, the kind of stuff that you pretty much have read about in the paper, baby killers and all that kind of stuff. But again, they clearly didn't understand who or what I was. They clearly couldn't read my insignia as a healthcare person and not a combatant. But again, I expected that. I was aware that was going on. I knew about it, and I just didn't run into any problems. that I had not anticipated.
Okay, and what kind of, I mean, you said that it was kind of the typical response of what people would say, but just to be more specific, I guess, what kinds of things were said to you? You know, was this in San Francisco? Was this in other places along the way?
Well, at the I came back from Vietnam essentially end of January, beginning of February of 69. There were a fair number of demonstrations going on around. Whether the people who made comments to me in San Francisco at the airport when I was getting ready to fly cross country, I don't know whether they were part of a organized demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
Just simply have been there and voiced their individual opinion. The comments there were people who sat near me and who made the comments about the baby killers. Those are the only two distinct things that I remember. There may have been other things and stuff at the time, and basically I just turned and walked away. I certainly did not end up in any kind of physical argument or verbal confrontation of any kind. When I got to D.C., I was only in D.C. overnight, but there were demonstrations going on in the D.C. area that I read about in the paper and saw in the news. I was not a part of those. And then, of course, the longer that I was home after Vietnam, the more I saw that on the news and the like. I never personally had a confrontation. I'm not the kind of person who would have, who having seen a demonstration, would go out and confront those people and exacerbate the situation. I would be more apt to just turn around and let them do their own thing and then go my own way. I don't see any purpose to asking for trouble. But clearly nobody confronted me either, except for that situation in the airport in California. People who wanted to demonstrate against the troops, almost everybody coming back from Vietnam was going to be coming into Oakland and then having to fly out of the commercial airport in San Francisco. So if you want to demonstrate against those troops, they're going to be easy to identify. You get out of the airport, you can pick, take your pick of the lot as to who you want to pick on. But I did not really have other than that experience.
And so when you came home, you said you came home once you got to New Hampshire. Your daughter was 11 months old at the time?
Yeah.
And so how was getting adjusted back to a life and all of a sudden a child?
It's hard to answer that question because I don't know what other options would have been like. My personal feeling is that it was at the time and still is today that it was probably better that I'd gone to Nam when I did than to have delayed it by asking for deferment. I don't know that it made any significant impact on the relationship with my daughter, but I don't know that it couldn't have been better if I'd done something else. I don't know that we, as far as I know, we've not had those kinds of major problems and stuff, and we certainly have had our disagreements at times. But she's getting married in October, and everything is still copacetic between us. But I can't say that it made a significant impact. Again, I think that at that time, the fact that I was home and that we were going to be relocating and being a family again was probably a little bit better and easier on my wife. It wasn't until my son's situation and what I described a little bit ago that we ended up in that really terrible period that I think we really grew in our ability to cope with adverse circumstances. After that, I think it was a very maturing experience, but at that point, at the time that I came back from Vietnam, it was just kind of good to be home, and everything looked like it was clearer, better, brighter for the future, and I don't think that there were any negative aspects that I can remember.
And what was that like being away at that, I guess, not just being away from family and wife in general, but at that point, too? And how did you cope with that? Was it just Mainly writing or talking when possible?
We exchanged pretty much daily mails, unless I just didn't have the time. Mm-hmm. The other thing was, I don't know if you remember in those days, but one of the hot technical items was these little small recorders, voice recorders,
mm-hmm.
That had kind of a little reel-to-reel thing. You could put them in a mailer and send them off. So we exchanged a fair number of those as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think coping under those circumstances was difficult. Interestingly enough, when I first went to Vietnam, because I was so busy right from the get-go for those first several weeks, I didn't really have the opportunity to get lonely or to think about my situation.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until after the post-Tet Offensive that those kinds of feelings occurred. I think at times, sure. I mean, you get to the point where you feel out of touch and somewhat alienated from friends and family, no matter how you feel about them. But I can't say that there were really major kinds of difficulties or problems.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had anticipated some of those. I knew what I was going, what it was going to be like for a year. I knew it was time limited. I think that's a positive. Those people, for example, in World War II, who went off to war and didn't return for 5 years, had a very much different situation than those of us who are in Vietnam and even today. Were even with extensions, mm-hmm. not going there for an interminable period of time. You knew your year was going to be up. It was, I'm sure you've probably heard the expression from some of the other people you've interviewed about setting up short-termers calendars.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Would set up these calendars and mark off the days and stuff. And that's good, although I will tell you that one of my experiences in Vietnam was, and I think the statistics bear this out, is that people who got killed or maimed often got killed or maimed in their first few weeks or in their last few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Their first few weeks because they didn't know any better and they did stupid things. In their last few weeks because they thought they had become invincible and they were going to get out unscathed. In fact, one of my best friends from growing up in grammar school was part of a group of five people from a reserve unit in New Hampshire. They were all killed on the last day. They were actually on their way back to Saigon to fly out to come home when they hit a landmine and were all killed. So I think that that's a very typical kind of pattern. I worried about that in my last few months. I figured, I got through this far. I don't want to be having a problem now. And so I think there were some of us who played it ultra safe in those last couple of months. But a large number of people get careless in those, especially in some of the combat troops. I recall one particular individual that I took care of who was making his last tour in a Jeep, a perimeter security tour with his replacement, and he was then going to be flying home. Again, they hit a landmine, and he ended up losing both of his legs. That's the kind of thing that I think happens too often because people tend to let their guards down. I try not to do that, but clearly there's always the risk that you're going to be injured in those circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And were there other particularly memorable instances or patients or days or events?
They are, but they're... I don't know. It's hard to... I can remember a couple you probably watched the movie MASH over.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody's experiences tend to run a gamut. There are clearly experiences that are really very tragic. The two that probably stick out most in my mind, three actually, there was a situation where one day I ended up doing anesthesia, for six different people, all of whom were basically having craniotomies or back surgery. All of them ended up with either paraplegia or quadriplegia because of their injuries.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty devastating. That's the only time in that year in Vietnam that I can remember going out and saying, why am I here? Didn't do very much for myself. The tragedy of it was really that. Another, on the negative side, was one day where we had four patients in adjoining beds. They were two on one side, two on the other, in the recovery room unit, all of whom had fat emboli. I don't know if you're familiar with fat emboli.
Nah.
You have fractures of long bones. The fat in the bones get into the bloodstream and go to the brain or heart or lungs. All of those four guys were dead within 2 hours of that time. Again, kind of depressing. That gets to be a tragedy. On the other end of the spectrum, there was one day that there was not very much going on. In fact, there was nothing going on. And there hadn't been anything going on for a couple of days, and so people started getting rambunctious. And we had a mouse in the OR, and somebody captured the mouse, and they decided, it wasn't me, I wasn't involved with this, but a good friend of mine was, and they decided we were going to operate on the mouse. So between a surgeon and an anesthetist, they anesthetized the mouse and operated on the mouse.
And exactly what kind of surgery was performed?
It was abdominal bowel surgery on the mouse. Unfortunately, the mouse died. But,
oh, my goodness.
You know, it was the kind of thing that, you know, and when I heard about it, I went over to the OR, too, and stuff. And by then, the mouse had already died. But people were obviously just bored and looking to do something to raise hell. Could you criticize it? Sure. But, again, I think it was not seen as being way out of touch. That did. The mouse was a problem for the operating room and you know, those kinds of things. People needed to get rid of the mouse anyways. They were able to capture him and they went ahead and did this, which was probably not right. there's a whole lot of little different specific memories like that. Like you said, the one with the four kids, six kids who operated, that we operated on that were left quadriplegic. That was really tragic. One of the other things that I saw that was really very difficult was where an anesthesiologist had to make a determination about a kid who was quadriplegic who was very likely to die and ended up having to take him off the ventilator because somebody else needed the ventilator more. That's really tragedy to see somebody die for that reason. And that was a difficult thing to watch. But, I couldn't argue, philosophically, ethically, that it wasn't the right thing to do. It was. Somebody else needed it more and was more likely to survive. But it's a tough decision that I wish nobody had had to make.
All right. And did you find at any point that because you were a male nurse that you were given different assignments?
No, I can't say that. I think that's a function of the anesthesia. I can't speak for those people who worked on the wards. I'm not aware that there were any assignment differences based on gender. In the operating room, at least in terms of the anesthesia, there never was. Not in Vietnam or any place else that I've ever been. Just has not happened. The only difference that I have seen over time was that there was a time when it was pretty classical. The surgeon would be a male, I would be the anesthetist, and everybody else would be female. I increasingly in the last few years have been in situations where it was female surgeon, female assistant, female circulators, female scrub nurse, and me, and I've been the odd man out. I think that's just a reflection of how gender equality issues have swung things around in terms of opportunities for a lot of women.
And how did all of that play out in the military with the women's movements and the gender equality?
You know, there are those who say that the Army or the military is America's greatest social experiment. And it is. I have to say that you'll remember back in the 60s, mid-60s, that the military came under a lot of criticism for its race issues.
Mm-hmm.
And those race issues have been around at least since World War II. But after 1965, and the Civil Rights Act, there clearly were big pushes to try to provide some kind of equality. And the Army changed its procedures and tried to change people's attitudes in a positive way. And I think probably faster than most of the other segments of America, they were able to provide equal opportunity for blacks and for minority groups, much more so than anybody in the civilian sector. I think that happened with gender equality as well, and probably even more readily in the healthcare area. When you're talking about healthcare in the military, as opposed to probably most other job areas, the healthcare people in the military differ only in that they end up putting a uniform on to go to work. In terms of our day-to-day relationships, in terms of what we do on a day-to-day basis, it's pretty much as exactly what we would do in the civilian sector.
Mm-hmm.
That may not be true for the banker or the baker or somebody else, but I can tell you that at least for healthcare, the relationships and the I think in part because of the educational experiential background of healthcare providers, there really isn't a big difference. And I think that was true for healthcare with regards to gender equality. The women were treated much better earlier in military and healthcare. Even today, they command a big share of the command and responsibility. Did they work their way to the top quickly? No. That happened over time. When I first went in, it had been all females who had been chiefs of the Corps, chief of the Army Nurse Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And we speculated as to whether a guy would ever get it. Nobody would, thought it was going to happen in their lifetime. But General Bill Bester, who was one of my former nurse anesthesia students, just retired as chief of the Army Nurse Corps. He was the first guy. And I think that says as much as to gender equality within the Army Nurse Corps as anything.
Mm-hmm.
It has always been in nursing a question of whether there was a possibility of reverse discrimination. And there were clearly a lot of guys who thought that there was. And I think Bill's experience has been that it doesn't have to be, it isn't, that everybody has an equal chance of making it to the top.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to write down notes, too, of things I think of as I go along, so not all of these fit a chronological or a thought pattern here. But one thing I wanted to ask you about was Mary Powell's book that recently came out, A World of Hurt. I wanted to know if you had seen that or read that. She was a nurse.
Sorry, what's the name of the title again?
A World of Hurt.
No.
She was a nurse at the 24th Evac. Okay. What about any of the other books by or about nurses in Vietnam?
Not in Vietnam per se, no. I've read some on the Bataan nurses and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. But not any of the Home Before Morning or any of those?
I've heard of some of them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've generally had book reviews and things like Army Times or some of the other areas or some of the nursing journals.
Mm-hmm. And what about the memorial in D.C., the women's memorial that was put in?
Yeah.
And kind of the debate or question of if that was the nurses' memorial or the women's memorial. what did you think about that and all of that movement?
I have some mixed feelings about that. One of the prime movers for that is Dee Lippman, who is a professor here at one of the nursing schools in the Bridgeport area, and also currently the president of the Connecticut Nurses Association. And she was a backer of the memorial right from the get-go. I have no problem with it, and I've seen the statue and stuff. There are those who obviously contend that there should have been some men included in the nurses' memorial. But again, it depends on how you define it, whether it's a memorial or a women's memorial.
Uh-huh.
But I don't have any really strong feelings one way or the other. I have some general feelings that while everybody deserves some attention, I think we're getting to the point where Perhaps we're having too many memorials in the D.C. area to different groups, and maybe some of that ought to be consolidated, but others feel differently.
Mm-hmm. And so what, let's say, I guess you came back from Vietnam, and you said you had had different training and different, different number of years, but what was it that made you stay in the military or decide to make that a career?
Well, like I say, after I had two or three tours, I got to like the military. I saw it as an area that had a lot of potential for upward mobility, for opportunities that I wasn't apt to find in the civilian sector. One of the biggies that I think people tend to underestimate, but which I think is particularly true for the nurse anesthetist, is the latitude of scope of practice. I remember I said earlier that one of the things that was particularly unique about Vietnam was that everybody in healthcare got to move up a notch. I think that has always been true of the military, the latitude of practice for nurses, doctors, and what have you. Tends to be much broader than it generally is in the civilian sector. There are some legitimate reasons for those. Legitimate reasons for that. One of them, of course, being the difference in liability, but also simply because it's a function of necessity that there are oftentimes in the military setting not enough people to do all the jobs, so everybody has to kind of share in and do stuff that somebody can pick up on something that somebody in the civilian sector. Somebody else in the civilian sector might have to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, things that I would not normally do in the civilian sector, like put in chest tubes, et cetera, are things that I got to do in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
That I think, and I think most healthcare people will tell you, broaden their scope and broaden their ability, their self-confidence, their level of self-esteem as a professional, et cetera, that I think played a positive role. And I think has generally had a positive impact post-Vietnam in the healthcare sector. I mentioned the development of medics and paramedics and PAs and other groups that really kind of all stepped out of that Vietnam experience because people had had the opportunity to do things they would not otherwise have had and who found that they enjoyed that kind of work and suddenly found an interest in committing to it as a life's work. And I think that that has paid very positive dividends. You can look at that in a lot of different areas. I mean, one of the real biggies that revolutionized healthcare in America was the medical evacuation helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
It had been around in Korea, but it was never used to the same extent it was after Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And it's become, you know, almost a de rigueur. Every metropolitan area in the country now has some kind of medical helicopter evacuation service on the civilian sector. It's made a big difference in saving people's lives.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that you've been very involved with the profession in general, too. You're vice president of the AANA, is that right? Are you finishing up your...
I have not run for this year for president-elect, so my term of office will be up in a couple of weeks. Yeah, I've always been involved with state and national associations, not only AANA, but the American Association of Nurse Attorneys chapter here in Connecticut, the Connecticut Nurses Association, the Connecticut Nurses Political Action Committee. I'm on the GRC, the Government Relations Committee, for both the Connecticut Association of Nurse Anesthetists and the Connecticut Nurses Association. So, yeah, I've been involved.
And is your wife still, did she practice as a nurse later?
Yeah. My wife's full-time employee. She's in long-term care.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, she's the assistant administrator of a nursing home down in Stamford, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
But she's previously served as a director of nursing in that area. She's done some oncology nursing. She's done pediatric nursing. She's done some general duty stuff. But for the last 10 or more years, she's been heavily involved in long-term care, first as director of nursing, and then as a consultant and as a corporate operations person,
mm-hmm.
and now as the assistant administrator. She earned her administrator's license last year, and when they ended up restructuring her facility, she ended up with the position of assistant. That's what she's doing now.
Mm-hmm. And what, or I guess she didn't join the Army, and military nursing wasn't what she did. I guess what was the difference?
What was the difference? My wife probably would have considered that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we did consider it, but the laws didn't allow for that in those days.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, they generally would not look favorably on a husband and wife team being members of the Army Nurse Corps, and the law specifically excluded you if you got pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And so my wife was a childbearing age, so she would have been in and out quite quickly, I suspect.
Uh-huh.
That just didn't seem possible. But,
uh-huh.
So she has continued to work in the civilian sector throughout. She did consider it. By the time they changed the rules, it was not entirely out of the picture, but she was well enough along in years that it would have, she'd still be in, for example, right now to complete a 20-year career,
mm-hmm.
And she felt she didn't want to do that at that point. But early on, it just wasn't feasible because it was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And are you happy with the way things have gone, your career and the military and the year abroad and all of that?
Yep. I also served abroad in Europe for 3 years.
Oh, uh-huh.
My military career. I think overall it's worked out reasonably well. I mean, there are ups and downs. There are some things that I guess I regret. Some other things that I don't regret. But I can't go back. I think one of the things that has distinguished my wife and I over the years is that we've always been people that we try to consider all the possibilities, and once we make a decision, even if it's a difficult decision, we don't look back. Because
mm-hmm.
I don't think that really gains you anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's generally decisions that we've been pretty happy with over the years. We don't know what the future holds, but hopefully.
Uh-huh. And so once you came back from Vietnam, and then I guess where were you stationed after that? After you?
When I came back from Vietnam, I was assigned to Aberdeen Proving Ground, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there for a year and a half, and then that's when I put in for long-term civilian schooling to go back and get my bachelor's. That was at the point in time that right after I was accepted for that and was getting ready to be reassigned, that my wife started having problems with pregnancy, and that we got into that downward spiral for several years.
Mm-hmm.
But we managed to get through it. It was not easy. It was a very difficult time for us. And I suspect that everybody in their lives gets through a period of similar difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
We've never had anything quite like it since then. But it just seemed for a while that everything that we decided or touched or did just turned to doo-doo. And it took us a while to turn that around.
Mm-hmm.
But once it did, things have generally been pretty good.
Mm-hmm. And so you got your BA through the civilian schooling, and then I saw in your email, I think you have an MA as well.
MED.
Okay.
I got the MED after I went back to school from Aberdeen Proving Grounds. I went back home to St. Anselm College, where I earned my BSN. At that time, I could do that in an accelerated framework based on prior college stuff that I'd already done.
Mm-hmm.
That was going to be changing, but I was able to get in. I finished by actually December of 71. I was credited with a 72 graduation date. And then was reassigned to Europe. I was in Munich for about 10 months till the end of the 72 Munich Olympics, and then was assigned to Heidelberg. I was at that point interested in eventually teaching in a nursing anesthesia program in the military. To do that, I needed a graduate degree, and Boston University had its education program available in the area of Heidelberg, Stuttgart. And I took courses there and finished in 74. It's essentially the same program that was offered here on the Boston campus. I finished that in 74 and then came back to me. I came back to the United States in January 75. I went to what is called the Officers Advanced Course, which is at that time 6 months long. And after that, I was reassigned to a teaching position at El Paso at William Baumann Army Medical Center. I was there doing didactic teaching for the first couple of years, then got involved in some other stuff, and then later went on to become a program director there, and was later reassigned to Tacoma, Washington, the Madigan Army Medical Center, and that's where I retired in 1984.
Mm-hmm. And then somehow, 20 years later, you're back on the other side of the continent.
Well, we were in Tacoma for, I guess, a total of about 12 years. I graduated in 84, and in 1990, I was at that time doing straight clinical, wanting to get back into teaching, and the job that was open was here in Bridgeport.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I ended up here. Plus, my wife and I wanted to come back to the East Coast because our folks were getting along in years, and we thought their health might deteriorate, and we wanted to be back here. So it seemed like a good opportunity. Well, her folks are still trucking along. They're in great health, and we're still here. I'm looking to probably get back into teaching if I can here in the next little bit. But I'm also looking at some other things. So,
mm-hmm. So you're technically retired, but you're still pretty busy.
Only in the sense of being retired from the Army. I tell people that I plan to work till I'm 75, but everybody thinks I'm joking, but I'm not. If my health holds up, I'd like to be able to say that I spent 50 years as a CRNA, and that means I'd have to work till I'm 74 or 75. And whether that'll be feasible or not, I don't know. I can tell you that there are other aspirations to my life that I would hope to fulfill before I retire, so I'm not about to hang up the hat just yet.
Wow, well, I really appreciate it. I think we've been through pretty much everything. Was there something that we didn't talk about that...
I can't think of anything. I guess I guess the only thing that I would kind of clarify is kind of what is the basic theme of your research? What kind of focus are you looking at? Are you just trying to provide a broad picture of what the guys who were nurses in Vietnam were like, or is there a more specific focus?
Well, part of what I'm doing, I'm from a history background. I'm not a nurse. I'm not from a military family or background anyway. So I'm kind of approaching this from a historical standpoint, and I'm trying to see kind of how the military is changing in the time and, you know, related that to the, you know, more male nurses coming into the profession, the women's movements, the war, and kind of how all of that plays together and changes nursing in the military. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do, trying to look at it from a lot of different angles with recruitment and you know, the different ways that men nurses were used or women nurses, or if that happened, you know, all kinds of different questions, portrayal of nurses, that sort of thing.
So that's an interesting area. If you start, there have been a couple of good articles that have been published about the image of nursing in the media and things like television and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting topic of itself. But in terms of specifically of men, I mentioned that when I went in, it was only about 1%. Now it's about 8%. I think you'll notice that there has been a big paradigm shift with regards to male nurses in the last, probably 5 or 6 years. And it probably hasn't been so dependent on the military, although the earlier shift in terms of providing some gender equality for guys was probably the military. The first male nurses, male nurses have always served in the military,
mm-hmm.
but they were not officers. They weren't recognized as Army Nurse Corps officers until 1956. And as a matter of fact, you talked about Bill Story, but the guy who's going to, in 2 weeks now, be the president of the ANA was one of my instructors at Walter Reed. He was the second Army Nurse Corps male officer commissioned,
uh-huh.
Frank Maziarski. There's a very excellent video you might want to get, and you can get it from the American Association of Nurses and Exodus on nursing's 100-year history with the Army. Army Nurse and Exodus is the focus. But it's a great film. It runs about 20 minutes, and it's still available. it would give you a lot of insights, and the number of the people who are in there are people that you probably have talked to or that would be known to you or accessible to you.
Mm-hmm.
In the post-Vietnam period, I think the impact of the military made a big difference. However, the shift that is occurring now is occurring for different reasons. If you look at the sudden rise in the number of male nurses nationwide in the last 5 or 6 years, the primary driving force is the socioeconomic changes. There are a lot of people who lost their jobs in the recession that lasted through till about just this past year or so. During that time, there were people, a large number of guys in particular, faced with having to relocate to a second, third, or fourth career. And that has created a large influx of the number of guys attending nursing programs, in part because of the idea that they bought into that it's a stable occupation, that if they finish, they will at least always have a job. Now, that's not an uncommon thought in nursing. It's been around for a long time. But I think more guys are buying into it. And so you've seen a very rapid influx here from 4 to 8% in terms of the number of male nurses in just the last half dozen years or so. And I suspect you've probably already been in touch with the American Nurses Association for some of the statistics on those numbers. That would be very useful to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's
the only question I can think of.
Okay. Great. Let me end the interview, and then I'll explain the forms and things that I'm going to send to you.